www.lifeinthepoets.org.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's holiday movie season. Hollywood has decked those Cineplex halls with tons of movies. Fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-land. Indeed, that's one of them, and it's a throwback to the days of Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire with Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling. Really? we'll find out. Natalie Portman portrays First Lady Jackie Kennedy and shows us the Kennedy assassination through her eyes. For the kids, there's Sing, a grand singing competition for the world's animated animals. And August Wilson's Tony and Pulitzer Prize-winning play Fences has been adapted for the screen with an all-star cast. Those are just a few of the tasty morsels Hollywood hopes you'll gobble up, but which are naughty and which are nice. That's the question. And what about the others? For answers, we turn to Bad Santa's favorite elves, Matt Brunson and Sean O'Connell. Matt Brunson is a film reviewer at Creative Living Charlotte. Sean O'Connell is movie content director for CinemaBlend.com. Welcome back, gentlemen.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Hi, you're welcome. Thank you for coming.
Yeah.
The Hollywood movie list I was given starts on November the 4th with films like Doctor Strange and Hacksaw Ridge, followed by Arrival and Moonlight a week later. Are those really holiday films, or are they just too old for that category now?
No, it's everybody trying to get in before the end of the year. And the problem is, especially these last few weekends, there's so many films that are just jammed into A, contend for Oscar consideration, but then also B, the tentpole blockbuster. You almost need a tentpole blockbuster, you know, every weekend now just to lure in mainstream audiences.
And it's the same thing as with summer, where they start now, first week of May, yeah. They begin basically the winter season first week of November.
And they seem to only – and you have big box office on some of these films the first weekend it opens and maybe the second week, and then they just kind of – they're replaced.
Well, and a lot of these films started their run at fall film festivals. So okay. They've been opening in limited release in other cities, bigger cities than Charlotte, unfortunately.
So the summer and the fall, I'm told, was kind of lackluster for movies. What does the Christmas season portend?
Well, box office wise, obviously it's going to be great because you have another Star Wars movie, you have a couple of animated offerings. Quality wise, I think it's kind of emblematic of the year as a whole. It was a good, not great year. Mm. Usually when I'm doing my 10 best, I have like 15 movies that like I have to whittle down. This year I had like 7 and I had to kind of stretch to figure out what else could be on it.
It seems it's becoming more difficult for movies. I mean, Julia Roberts, who is a movie star in capital letters, emboldened, underlined, put in red type. She's a movie star. She's going to do a television show
right
next year. And right. We have all these people coming to HBO and Showtime and Netflix and places like that to do TV, and they're all movie people. Mm-hmm. Are we going to see a time when Hollywood does what some of the networks are beginning to do now and just stream these things for new release, out of the box, right to you, and heck with the Cineplex?
I wonder what the time frame will be. Yes, that will happen.
Because if you got a 70-inch screen, do you right. really need to go to a movie theater and be annoyed by a teenager on their phone texting through the entire film?
But the price point for that right now, from what we're hearing, is $50. Like, they're going to start that experiment at offering these first-run features.
No one's going to pay that.
Well, but you may, because if you buy Passengers, you know, at your house, yeah. and you invite 4 couples over, you know, Friday night we're going to order a bunch of pizzas and everyone's going to watch Passengers without having to go to the theater.
You're going to sell tickets at the front door?
Well, they all chip in, right? If everyone throws in $10, you have a movie night at your house in your gorgeous home entertainment center, and then you've created the theater. Now, is that what everybody wants? No. A lot of people want the communal aspect of going to the theater, but there's also a lot of people who don't want that and would be very happy to watch.
And there's still certain movies that are always going to look better on the big screen.
Sure.
And that's why I think it's the same thing with
– But isn't it relative? If you have a 50, 65, 70-inch screen in your home and you're 5 feet away, isn't it the same thing as putting it on a gigantic screen in a Cineplex and being, I don't know, 40 feet away?
No, you could say the same thing about books. I mean, everybody thought, oh, they'd be gone by now because everybody still be reading them on their Kindles. But, you know, some people just like the feel, the look.
What are these books
that you speak of?
No, but you know
titles
really
like Calvin and Hobbes, you know, classics.
Like, theaters are also going the opposite direction. And, like, Regal Stonecrest is putting a ton of money into renovating their theaters to put in chairs that make you feel like you're at home.
Yeah.
The reclining seats.
They're wonderful. I've been to those theaters. Yeah. They're wonderful.
Oh, they're great.
I love them. I may move in.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But and also, how long will they keep up, right? Like, they're really – they're new and splashy right now, but in a year or two from now
– Yeah, it's not like your house. It gets a lot more traffic.
It gets a lot more traffic.
So let's go back to some of those early arrivals in the Cineplex for the holidays. Let's start with Arrival. In fact, it's a film you both have on your favorites of the year list. I've only seen the trailer, which doesn't give away much other than alien ships arrive and a woman is called out to communicate with them. And I was going to ask, is this more than an updated version of Close Encounters of the Third Kind? But Matt, you've already said Arrival is Independence Day with a brain.
Oh, hey, that's mine.
That's
Is that yours?
That's mine.
I get the two of you so confused
Don't
sometimes.
Steal one of my best
I'm
lines.
I'm sorry.
Come on, I don't have a lot of them. Give me the ones I have.
So is it also Close Encounters?
No. Well,
yeah, I would say so.
It's close to that. What happens is it deals with the idea of first contact, right? If aliens were to arrive on our planet, how would we react? And in a Roland Emmerich movie, like an Independence Day, the military comes out and we're blasting everything we have at them. In this film, it's incredibly intelligent. It talks about how can we establish communication with this alien race to figure out what they want. And even when they do establish some form of communication, the aliens share a word and its weapon. And so the military is like, whoa, we have to respond. And Amy Adams, who plays a linguist, is very quickly saying, well, we need to figure out what weapon even means to them. Like, it could mean tool. It could mean – so it's all about the small steps that you should take when you're going through this process of trying to establish communication in a potential conflict. And it's just incredibly, incredibly smart.
One of you said – I thought it was Matt, but it could have been you, Sean. One of you said that the less you know going into this movie, the better off you are. Was that you?
Absolutely. Well, probably
I could
both
be either of us.
Yeah, probably
both of us. Yeah, it really is the less you know. Although I will say that the movie employs this flashback structure, which you're like, oh, not again flashbacks. But the way it does it in this movie always keeps you off guard. You're like trying to figure out past, future, present. And it's just done in a really intelligent and innovative way.
And in fact, when you know everything about the movie, when it lays out everything it has, and then you go back and watch it a second time, it's that much smarter. Because then you realize all the places where the director gave you a lot of knowledge that you just didn't even know you had at the time. And it's just very rewarding.
People who come out of it and won't tell you what it was about because they don't want to ruin it for you seem to be really happy about it. Really, it's uplifting or happy or does something to them internally. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it's rare when a movie works as well as this one does, right? Like, there are a lot of them that reach for the star. We were talking about Passengers and how it had a really great premise but doesn't pay off. Arrival has an excellent premise that actually pays off all the way through. So you kind of want to protect that secret for as long as you can and not give it away for somebody.
Passengers is that movie, if I'm not mistaken, about the bunch of astronauts, I guess, are in the spaceship and they're going off to wherever they're going. And several of – it's Jennifer Lawrence and Chris Pratt star.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it's a 120-year journey to another planet. They put them to sleep and these two wake up prematurely.
Well, one of them does.
Okay.
Yeah, Chris Pratt does. And then it's about what decisions he makes. Is he going to be alone for the rest of his life? Like, he can't get back to sleep. And should he go through the process of waking someone else up, ruining their life, you know, but he wouldn't be alone anymore.
Meaning that they will die if they wake up?
Sure, because they can't get back to sleep. They won't reach their destination. They still have 90-something years to go.
90 years, yeah.
Wow. So. It looks interesting, and you say it's not. Why isn't it interesting? It looks interesting.
It is. It starts out interesting. It's got a great look to it. The whole premise, I don't think they're honest with it, especially toward the end. I mean, you could definitely tell a guy wrote this movie. It's kind of a male fantasy type movie. And then the final half hour just goes completely bonkers.
Because you're all alone with Jennifer Lawrence for 120 years.
Kind of. He doesn't wake up, you know, a beer-bellied companionship.
That's coming. All right. Doctor Strange. It looked like to me that it was aimed at teenage boys, at least from the trailer that I saw. But it's another Marvel Comics operation. But again, it stars Benedict Cumberbatch. So perhaps I thought maybe they have a different audience in mind. Which is it?
No, that's the same audience with a really classy actor at the front. It's I don't know. I wasn't as enthralled with this one as some of the past ones. I think there is some kind of a – as much as Marvel is trying not to have a formula set in, I think it kind of is to an extent. Having said that, it's got – he's definitely wonderful in it and it's got some interesting visuals.
He plays a neurosurgeon who he's in an automobile accident and he can't use his hands. Is that right?
Yes.
And he finds out about what could be a cure somewhere in the Far East, mm-hmm. and goes out and meets Tilda Swinton, the Ancient One. I'm sure she's thrilled with playing that part. who trains him in the mystical arts. Okay, so the Marvel aspect of this has been revealed, but you say it's less than Marvel-less.
No, I liked it. I mean, what happens with Marvel is we're at the point now where you're getting to not third-string characters, but ones who you probably never thought would get their own film, right? And so – but they still keep bringing these great cast members, and it's all to build towards a larger tapestry. Like, they're going to have another Avengers film, and all these people are going to be in it. So you'll get to a point where, like, Robert Downey Jr. is sharing scenes with Benedict Cumberbatch, and that's just appealing to me. I just think they're – I think they could be a lot of fun together. So Marvel's got their whole thing going. This has been a really interesting year for the superhero genre because you have – DC trying to get Batman versus Superman off the ground, and then Marvel is just rolling out Captain America Civil War and Doctor Strange. And going into next year, I mean, we're not getting a lot more of these. We're not getting less of these. So it's interesting to see where the industry is going with this.
But
we'll never hit fatigue.
I understand that some people are offended by this because they've done some things to the characters and the setting based on geopolitics.
Yes,
and some people are unhappy about that. Why?
Well, in the comic
The Ancient One.
The Ancient One.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is Asian. It's an old Asian man.
Tibet, that's what it was.
Yeah.
And they didn't want it. Disney did not want to offend the Chinese market because
it's the biggest market outside of this
market
in the world.
So that's why they changed it and made it a white woman, which I think is pretty shameful, but hey.
It's like us putting a Fidel Castro movie in where? Miami Beach.
But Ryan Gosling as Fidel Castro.
Yes.
He would crush that.
Okay.
Hacksaw Ridge, despite sounding like something out of Ode to Billy Joel, Joe by Bobby Gentry, this is a war movie and Sean, a Mel Gibson movie at that.
Yes.
And you say, I think this is you saying this.
Let's see.
It tells a story worth telling.
Yes.
Are those your words?
Those are my words.
But you go on to say the way they tell it isn't always worthy.
Well,
talk about that.
It's a very heroic story about Desmond Doss, who he's a pacifist who still wants to fight for his country. And he ends up on the battlefield. He refuses to pick up a weapon. He ends up in a very brutal conflict, which is where Mel Gibson just, you know, that's Mel's bread and butter, essentially. He may even go a little over the top, depending on your taste for all of this. But what Desmond Doss does is he manages to rescue, is it 80-something, 70-something soldiers who have been injured in battle? He gets them off of the battlefield almost single-handedly while avoiding the enemy forces. And when you see that play out, it's, like I said, an incredibly heroic act. It's just that the early part of the film, which establishes his home life, is extremely melodramatic. And then when you get to the battle scenes, they're almost like stomach-churningly, you know, gross and over the top. Now, that's what Mel Gibson does. If you've seen Braveheart or Passion of the Christ, you understand that he really loves to revel in that. So I think the story of Desmond Doss is absolutely worth telling, and I'm glad that I saw it because I didn't know anything about him.
It's based on a true story.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's like a Sergeant York for a new generation because he's a pacifist. He refuses to pick up a gun. So he does all this without ever once touching a rifle while he's rescuing everybody. And that's, I think, what makes it different.
So given the grossness of the battle scenes and the earnestness of Andrew Garfield, who plays the lead character, does it work? Does Mel Gibson add something to the mix that makes it work?
I thought it did work. Yeah, I thought once you got to that to those sequences, it worked. It's just it's an intense sit. Like you picture that the first few minutes of Private Ryan, which is the D-Day invasion, stretched over an hour. After a while, no matter who you are, you're going to be waving a white flag saying, I can't see another limb get blown off.
You could come away from the first 15 minutes of Private Ryan with PTSD. I mean, that's how graphic it is. World War II movies seem to be dwindling, I guess, because that generation is going away. But we have two World War II movies, and we'll come back and talk about the other one in a second. It's called Allied with Brad Pitt and Marion Cotillard. Coming right back with Sean O'Connell and Matt Brunson in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Doctors Making House Calls. Over 75 clinicians making more than 85,000 home visits annually, providing comprehensive primary care to patients in their home, workplace, or senior community. Information and registration at doctorsmakinghousecalls.com. And Wake Forest University Certificates Program with courses in design thinking, diversity, and financial management for non-financial managers. Details at charlotte.wfu.edu/certificates program. Well, there's something called the Charlotte Way, an ill-defined, unwritten code representing a level of community engagement to tackle problems. But former Bank of America CEO Hugh McCall contends that shouldn't be the way Citi responds to the kinds of economic and societal issues the Keith Scott shooting brought to the surface. So Hugh McCall and former Mayor Harvey Gantt will join us on this program tomorrow to talk about the Charlotte Way and ideas on new ways to move forward at 9.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, after multiple setbacks, evacuations of Syrian civilians and fighters had resumed in eastern Aleppo. President Assad could soon have full control of the city. The latest on the humanitarian crisis, the future of the Syrian conflict, and its international repercussions.
The Ian Rehm Show this morning at 10 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Matt Brunson, film reviewer of Creative Loafing Charlotte, and Sean O'Connell, movie content director for CinemaBlend.com,
yes,
and
sir.
Also NBC6,
yes.
WCNC-TV. Okay, there's another World War II story in theaters this Christmas called Allied, as we said, starring Brad Pitt and Marion Cotillard. He's an intelligence officer. I believe she's a resistance fighter whose relationship is tested by a potentially damaging secret. She may be a double agent for the Nazis. It looks intriguing on the one hand, but on the other hand, I don't know what it is about it. I feel a little uneasy. Should I feel that way?
No, but most audiences did. It's not doing that great. I personally liked it. I thought it was a nice, more adult movie than we get at this time of year. Mm-hmm. I thought they had good chemistry together, and it's just interesting to follow to see if she really is going to be a double agent. It's one of those really don't know until the end. And that's unusual today because usually you could pretty much figure out from the beginning which way the plot's going to go.
You going to tell us?
No.
Because you call it an elegant and understated movie for adults, one that's as unfussy as it is engaging. And you even bring up Casablanca.
Mm. Well, I'm not saying it's in that level, but I'm saying it's that type of movie where it's not unlike Hacksaw Ridge. It's not about the battles. It's more about the personal relationships that go on with the backdrop of war.
Okay. Is this the movie where he split with his wife, Brad Pitt?
Or allegedly. Allegedly. Although Cotillard comes out and says no. I mean, This is...
There are two very different, and I'm going to call them coming-of-age films because they sound like coming-of-age films to me, and you can correct me because you've seen them, but they're coming out, I think they came out in November, Moonlight and The Edge of 17, both of which got very high Rotten Tomatoes ratings. Moonlight is about a young man's struggle to find himself and follows him from childhood into adulthood, which sounds like that Linklater movie, Boyhood.
Yeah.
Edge deals with what it's like to grow up as a young woman today. So talk about those two films. Am I on the right track? Are they both coming-of-age films in a way?
In a way, except they're wildly different.
Okay.
In terms of what they want to do. Edge of 17 very much wants to be sort of the next John Hughes-type film. It's a little bit more based in comedy, although it wasn't as funny as I thought it was going to be. It is really funny in parts. I mean, Woody Harrelson plays a teacher who Haley Steinfeld is the girl who he confides in, but she's going through normal sort of teenage things, I think. Moonlight is more about an African-American boy who's growing up, who's dealing with sexuality problems and how he has to sort of be raised in a difficult community and come to terms with all these emotional problems he has inside. Right. It's way more serious. It's more of a...
Well, and also Edge of 17 is really just about, you know, this one few months in this girl's life, whereas Moonlight is a three-act movie. I mean, it's when he's a small boy, when he's a teenager, and then when he's a grown man. So it kind of takes you through a longer period.
And you say Edge, Matt, joins The Fault in Our Stars and An Education is one of the brightest coming-of-age films.
Yeah, really? I really liked it. I think Haley Steinfeld is really amazing in this. It's really – I think it had a lot of humor, not just Woody Harrelson, although he's very funny in this movie, but just in the way she's trying to cope with, you know, the fact that her best friend is now dating her brother, which is a very odd situation. And then there's a classmate who's kind of on the nerdy side, but he really likes her, and she's trying to figure out her relationship with him. So I just thought it was delightful the whole way through.
There's also a film that both of you, again, have in your top five favorites of 2016 called Sing Street. This is about a boy growing up in Dublin during the 1980s. Why are you laughing?
Because I thought you were going to stop at Sing, which is an animated film about talking animals.
Yeah. Sing Street. It's about a boy growing up in Dublin during the 1980s who escapes his strained family life by starting a band to impress the mysterious girl that he likes. What makes it so good?
John Carney is the director, and he did
Once,
thank you very much. And he just knows how to weave music through these extremely emotional coming-of-age stories. This is one of those films that every other day I just sort of put on in the background because the screenplay is so fantastic and the
lines
are so great.
You put movies on in the background?
Oh, yeah. I work to movies all the time. Yeah, but the music in this one, it's all original songs.
That helps.
And it's about this kid
who's... We'll get him the soundtrack for Christmas.
...growing up to be a songwriter. And it's just really, it's really, really funny. I mean, if you ever played in a band, if you like pop music to any extent, John Carney really knows what he's talking about in terms of that era, the 80s, and bands like Duran Duran and The Cure, and it's just such a winning crowd pleaser.
Yeah, if you have any fondness for the 80s and on, I know a lot of people don't, but if you do, you're really going to like this movie because it really nails, like, they make their own music video, and it's so gloriously campy in just the same way as a lot of those 80s ones were. That's, like, probably my favorite scene in the movie. I just love that.
The riddle of the bottle.
Yeah,
it's a really funny one. But it's just great. It also deals with some cliche type things, like his family is falling apart at home. He's got an older brother who's, you know, sort of a slacker, but, you know, smarter than you would assume, has more wisdom to it. And it's about how the older brother sort of helping the little brother come into his own, both as a songwriter and just as a person. And it's just it's so great. I mean, I have not recommended it to anybody who came back and was just like, it was all right. Like, everyone who sees it just falls in love with it.
Okay. It's called Sing Street. Mm-hmm. The enormously successful Harry Potter series of films has found a new way to live on with a spinoff that uses Potter mythology with a different set of characters. Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them is the name of the film. J.K. Rowling wrote it. This is the first chapter in what she hopes will be a new franchise. Should we be as excited about it as we maybe were about the initial Harry Potter movie?
Maybe. I don't know. I liked it a lot. I mean, it's a lot of fun. Harry Potter went on for, what, 7 movies?
Yes.
I don't imagine I could sit through 7 of these.
8? Is it 8 movies? 7 books and 8 movies?
Yeah, you're right. 8 movies. It's fun, like I said, but the characters, there aren't as many great characters as there were in the Potter series, what we've seen so far.
And there's a big bit of this first movie that is set up for what they now say are going to be 5 films.
Is this a prequel or a sequel to Harry Potter?
It takes place way before Harry Potter, but it's not even supposed to, like, lead into the Harry Potter films. It's just its own separate story.
And it's interesting to me that they hired who played Harry Potter? I can't think of his name right now.
Daniel Radcliffe.
Daniel Radcliffe, whom that series made him an important person and a famous person. Mm-hmm. But the lead in this is already famous, Eddie Redmayne,
right.
Who's in every other movie that's being put out, playing a British wizard casting about in New York with a suitcase full of beasts. So is this a veiled attempt to show how the Harry Potter franchise crossed the Atlantic?
Well, they do name dropping. I mean, they mentioned Dumbledore, so it's kind of like The Hobbit. Prequels and that there's going to be a lot of stuff for the fans to recognize.
Well, I think it's almost like Rogue One also in the way that it's a story that takes place in an existing universe that fans know and love and want to return to, but just following different characters.
Okay. So here's a very basic question for the two of you. Must we talk about Bad Santa 2?
No.
Good. Okay, fine.
Next.
But Billy Bob Thornton is in it. Kathy Bates is in it.
Yep.
How can it be bad? Let's start with a title.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. What about Office Christmas Party? Do we need to talk about that? It features Saturday Night Live's Kate McKinnon, who's in everything all of a sudden.
She's the best spot, but I prefer Bad Santa, too.
Do you really?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't care much for either of them, but I laughed a little more.
And T.J. Miller, who's in Silicon Valley on television, is in it, too. And you said, Matt, that the actors are appealing. The gags occasionally inspire a smile, but not a single gut-busting laugh. That's probably not what the filmmakers were going for, right?
Really?
They went for mild laughs.
As mild laughs. We don't want you to hurt yourself. It's too close to the holidays.
It is strange. Like, that's a movie where if you don't see it now, like, who's going to rent Office Christmas Party 6 months from now,
exactly.
You know, from the Red Box? Hey, let's see this Office Christmas Party. This sounds great.
get it now for $50 and invite the friends over.
Right, exactly.
Okay, Loving is based on the true story of Richard and Mildred Loving. They're an interracial couple who helped to change the race laws in Virginia. It came out around Thanksgiving. I remember this story because I was growing up in Virginia. I remember this happening. At the time, their illegal marriage took place in 1967, I think. And I'm actually surprised that this story has taken so long to make it to the screen.
There was a documentary.
Yeah, but given the advent of same-sex marriage, does it seem somehow more topical now?
I guess so. This strikes me as one of those films that it's extremely important. You know, the topic is relevant, as you say, and the cast is uniformly great. It's one of those movies that just, to me, it didn't really hook me. And it has something to do with the direction. It's very low-key. It's muted and subdued by design. And I think that's why it's not really catching on. Like, people aren't really talking about it in a way that they should as we get into sort of the awards pedigree season. But there's nothing wrong with it. I liked everything about it. It just wasn't one of those ones where you come out and you're like, man, you have to go see.
Would it have been helped by better-known actors in the lead roles? Would that have drawn
people
in? No, because
they're both really good.
Yeah, they're both really good in it. That's not the problem. I can't even put my finger really on a problem with it. It's just one of those movies where it didn't inspire quite the passion that other films have.
Hmm. Sean, I know that you love animation, if I'm not mistaken.
I do, yes.
And so we'll talk about Moana.
Yes,
how you say it?
Please.
Moana. Another Disney movie. It features a young girl, a Polynesian princess, who sets out to save her people with the help of a demigod on some ancient islands. And in the process, you know, all land surface on the globe is ancient. So I don't know why this is an ancient island. But nonetheless, in the process of doing all this, she discovers her own identity. And it features songs from Lin-Manuel Miranda, who, of course, is the composer and star of Hamilton. 95% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yes.
You liked it, too.
Oh, I loved it. And I maybe liked it more than you did. I'm not quite sure. Did I really? God, it was fantastic. And
you don't have this on in the background while you work?
My kids can't stop listening to the soundtrack to this. It's in our car. And that's what I love about it. It's to me, a return to Beauty and the Beast and The Lion King, where the music is integral to the story. The songs, you know, it builds to song. Right. And with each one, and even the one that I didn't really care for all that much, which was The Rock's singing You're Welcome, is the one that's in my head all the time now. Like, I know how the kids who watched Frozen last year feel because I'm constantly humming these songs.
Did Miranda write all of it?
I believe so.
All of the songs?
I believe he did. But it's not only that. Like, the way that they marketed this film, it seemed like it was just going to be like goofy and strange in an Emperor's New Groove kind of way. Mm-hmm. So I went into it with such low expectations, and I loved the story. The story was really, really well done. It's about a girl who feels this call to the ocean, but her father needs her to stay on this island because she's going to be the next leader of their people. But then, of course, for some reason, she has to leave the island and she goes off on this adventure on her own. And when it gets to this resolution, it was such a sweet and tender resolution. I loved the story.
I mean, the trailer makes it look like Shrek.
No, it's not. They,
no,
I,
it's
that's
not
what I'm
Shrek.
Saying. It's,
yeah.
it's
because you got this garrulous character. You got a chicken that's like the donkey.
Yes, that's the thing. I don't know how they sort of botched the marketing on this.
I don't know that they botched it so much. I liked it as well. To me, it's part of it's like with the Marvel movies. They're kind of the formula now, and this one kind of follows the same thing. And to be honest, as much as I liked it, you know, after Zootopia, which is one of my favorites of the year, which was so original, every other animated movie this year seems to be lacking a little something.
Zootopia is going to make my top 10, and I kind of want to cheat and couch Zootopia and Moana together, because this year for Walt Disney Animation was spectacular with the two of them. And I mean,
even animation, you could put Sausage Party in there too.
I did not put Sausage Party in there. That was terrible. But, you know, in a year where Pixar is putting out Finding Dory, which was good. It was, you know, not a bad, you know, it's
I
a
liked
sequel.
Finding Dory.
Finding Dory's fine.
No, I didn't see the sequel. I saw the first one.
Then don't say you liked it.
Well, what was the first one called?
Finding Nemo.
Finding Nemo. I liked Finding Nemo. Dory's not good?
No, it's fine.
Okay.
It's fine. Yeah, it's fine. Right. But when Pixar is cranking out sequels and Walt Disney Animation is pushing the envelope with original stories.
Well, is this a new kind of Disney princess? I mean, they say that Disney's trying to craft these characters that appeal to little girls so that they are no longer dependent on the handsome prince kissing them and making their lives complete.
Yeah, that's very much the case with this. But yet, Moana – which is the girl in the story, and Maui, who's the one voiced by The Rock, have their own arcs. Like, I think that neither of them gets shortchanged, and neither one of them has to rely necessarily on the other to complete their task. They succeed independently.
With no romance.
With no romance, yes. Which is great. Like, it's not like they have to fall for each other at the end of it because it's part of the – so you say formula. I don't think that there's as much of the formula in play for that reason. And the music is great. The music is so good.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Miranda, he really understands musicals.
Absolutely.
Obviously. Yes. That's an understatement.
Yes. Breaking news.
But you brought up Zootopia, and I know it's not a Christmas movie, but it's on your top five list, Matt, and it's an animated film. So What made that so special this year?
It starts, I think, first of all, with the characters. The lead is this little bunny rabbit who wants to become a cop. She would become the first rabbit who becomes a cop in the metropolis of Zootopia. And I just think the way the whole story goes, and it's very topical with like trying to instill fear in people about the other types of people. I think it's both topical and just funny and fresh, just in a way that I haven't seen at the movies much of it this year.
It's interesting. We spent a lot more time talking about an animated movie or two than we've spent talking about any of these other movies. Is that just simply because you guys like animation so much, or is it because something's going on in animation that adults should pay attention to?
No, not necessarily.
Well, they're making more and more because, you know, they got their own Oscar now, about 15 years ago. Right, so there's going to be more of those. They upped the best original song category back to 5. So you're going to get a lot more musical numbers. And most of all, if you look at the top 10, top 20 movies of the year box office-wise, they're almost all either animated movies, superhero movies, or science fiction. So there's just going to keep being more and more. And luckily, with that percentage, we're going to get a lot more good ones.
Speaking of stories centered on living by the ocean, as the Moana is, there's another film on Matt's top five list for 2016. I don't think it's on yours, Sean. No, it's not. But Manchester by the Sea.
So it's another animated movie.
Yeah, no, it's not. just the opposite. This was just chosen as the National Board of Review's Best Film of the Year. And when its star, Casey Affleck, appeared, I think it was last week on Saturday Night Live, he kept referring to it as as depressing and, and morose, and don't go see it, because you'll just be depressed, which I thought was an interesting way to promote the film.
Yeah, it's part of the marketing.
Is it that depressing?
It's pretty depressing. and it's really amusing that the Oscar season comes at the same time as the year-end holiday movies, because they're going to want to be showing these kind of more low-budget, serious movies. And the audiences, you know, general audiences are going to go, hey, let's go see a, you know, animated musical, or let's go see a movie about death and despair and depression.
Right.
But if you're into that, or if you don't mind seeing that during
the
season.
Well, the holidays are a depressing time. For a lot of people.
That's true.
So if you really want to be depressed or want to see somebody else more depressed than you are.
Yes. Then go see Manchester by the Sea.
And this is complete decision on the studio's part. Manchester played at Sundance, you know, last January. So they've been sitting on it. They're waiting to release it so it's as close to award season as possible. So this is very strategic.
And you've called Matt, you called Casey Affleck's work here revelatory.
You know, he gets overshadowed because Ben's his, you know, Ben Affleck's his older brother. But
The Batman?
But a few years ago, he had this terrific performance in his brother's Gone Baby Gone, and also the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. Mm-hmm, right. So we've already known he could act, and this movie just really cements that fact.
Also, his scene, right, the big scene that he builds to is such a subdued, you know, but gut-wrenching scene, and he underplays it to the value of the material.
More on what's in the movies for the holiday season and the theaters for the holiday season with Sean O'Connell and Matt Brunson in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Fresh Market. The Fresh Market has introduced a new selection of baby essentials, from baby foods to wipes and diapers, in their Charlotte area stores, with products for the family all at Fresh Market locations. And the Cabarrus Arts Council, featuring the Clay 2016 exhibition, a showcase of 23 North Carolina potters, wood-fired and salt-fired vases or vases, and decorative pieces available through the holidays. Details at cabarrusartscouncil.org. After multiple setbacks, evacuations of Syrian civilians and fighters have resumed in eastern Aleppo. President Assad could soon have full control of that city. So the latest on the humanitarian crisis, the future of the Syrian conflict, and its international repercussions, the topic of the conversation coming up on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock. I'd like to thank you for making WFAE's winter membership campaign a success. Your donation is an investment in quality journalism and trustworthy news for the entire region. So thanks. We really appreciate your support.
Doug Singleton, Executive Director, Charlotte Ballet, a WFAE underwriter.
In the ever-changing world of media today, WFAE remains a constant in our plans because every member of our community in Charlotte looks to WFAE and to Charlotte Ballet to create a vibrant and inclusive community.
Underwriting on WFAE says a lot about your business. To learn more, email underwriting at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Matt Brunson, film reviewer for Creative Loafing Charlotte, is here along with Sean O'Connell, movie content director for CinemaBlend.com and a critic for WCNC NBC6 here in Charlotte. Warren Beatty is back in a film. It's been a long time since he's been in a film. He co-wrote, directed, and stars as Howard Hughes in Rules Don't Apply. Well, after Leonardo DiCaprio played Hughes in a devastating portrayal, I thought, well done, does the world need another film about a guy that people are quickly forgetting about?
No.
Not really.
Okay.
No, I didn't think so.
How does Beatty do in all three jobs as co-writer, director, and star?
He's fine, especially as an actor. I've always enjoyed his performances and the types of characters he plays. It's just – it's one of those movies that feels a little too little too late, as you said. There's already been a movie about him that Scorsese did, The Aviator, and this doesn't really add anything to the conversation.
It's also paced very erratically, and I think it's by design because Hugh's brain is always like all over the place, and the movie sort of follows that pattern, and which I thought was enjoyable.
I liked it,
to a certain extent, but it has no traction at all.
You know, I look back on the show we did at this time last year, and we spent the whole first segment last year talking about the return of the Star Wars franchise. Mm-hmm. They plan to release, I think, one movie a year in this next trilogy. So last year was the first. This year is the second, and it's called Rogue One, a Star Wars story. Larry Topman, you'll pardon the expression, the film critic for the Charlotte Observer, savaged this movie.
He did not like it.
He tore it to pieces. I mean, it's fun to read. he called it a Star Wars story. And warned that if other such mediocrities from the franchise are in the wings, may the force be against them. So, Sean, you've warned parents that this one is not for kids, but is it as derivative as Larry Topman thinks it is?
No. I mean, and I love Larry to pieces. I don't know why he didn't. And I didn't love this one. I liked it. I thought it was fine. This tells a story that exists before A New Hope, which is the very first Star Wars movie, and it fills in some gaps and celebrates some characters that we heard about but have never seen before. And by the end of it, I thought, well, that was perfectly fine. Like, I didn't need that story, but I enjoyed it while I was watching it. But when I came out of The Force Awakens last year, what J.J. Abrams did in rejuvenating the franchise, I couldn't wait to get back into a theater and see
that
again.
I thought that was completely derivative. Yeah. I thought that's the first movie all over again.
And I understand that criticism, but I like the way J.J. makes popcorn thrillers. I think that they're shiny and they move. And
to be clear, this isn't the second in the new trilogy.
Right.
This is like no, that's next year. This is like a standalone movie. Mm-hmm. That's why they're going to be able to do one a year. they're just going to have all these filler ones. Having said that, though, I thought it was well done. I think there are some questions that you may have had, you know, 100 years ago with the first Star Wars, that they actually do a good job of filling in.
And is this not for kids because Mel Gibson directed the battle scenes in this? A lot of battle scenes in this. A lot of people die.
By design, it's a darker
story.
Even
an android dies.
An android,
lovable android.
These are spoilers that you're giving away now.
Oh, I'm sorry.
This is the end of them. But there is something to be said they let the director make a war picture. He wanted to make a war picture, and they used Star Wars characters, but I just don't think that it plays to a younger audience. It's not supposed to, and I think that's fine.
Okay,
but
so this is for adults.
Yes.
Okay. Who grew up on the Star Wars franchise?
Yeah, right. More fans our age.
PG-13 or PG?
It's got to be PG-13.
Yeah, one more thing.
Clothes designer and snappy dresser Tom Ford is the writer-director of something called Nocturnal Animals, a romantic thriller with Amy Adams and Jake Gyllenhaal as a divorced couple with dark truths.
Yes.
Do tell.
This is maybe the first one that we really disagree on. I really like this movie a lot, but I can't quite figure out why. Because it tells two stories. It's Amy Adams in the present day reading a book that her estranged husband wrote. And you don't know if it's about them or how it's about them kind of thing. And you watch this story that's from the book playing out. And that's where Jake Gyllenhaal, to me, really shines. Like, that dude puts himself through the ringer all the time.
He's very intense.
And the Oscar never wants to recognize him for all the work that he puts in. I loved him in this side story. He gets great screen time with Michael Shannon. Aaron Taylor Johnson, who I don't necessarily care for all the time, has an amazing role as this like sinister sort of desert drifter. The bit with Amy Adams I thought was kind of cold and clinical, but I like what Tom Ford did.
And Matt, you have said that this time Tom Ford opted to replace the film's beating heart with a leaden paperweight. You loved this movie, didn't you?
Fantastic. Actually, I was mixed on it. I didn't hate it. I thought it had some good stuff. Like he said, Jake Gyllenhaal's terrific. The two stories, I understand how they connect. I just didn't think they really connected that well. It's really, you know, we're talking about some unpleasantry in movies. This is really unpleasant for a stretch. I mean, it makes Manchester by the Sea look like Zootopia.
Great. So, a double feature.
There you go.
All right. There's this movie I've been seeing trailers for a lot, and when I first saw it, I thought, oh my gosh, this is going to be great. The cast is great. Mm. But now I'm hearing things about it. Collateral Beauty.
Nice.
Star Will Smith. Indeed. With appearances by an all-star cast. Helen Mirren, Edward Norton, Kate Winslet, Keira Knightley, among others. Matt, you hated this film.
Yes.
Why?
The premise is one of those that I think could be pulled off with really great writing and kind of that magical realism touch that, like, as I put in my review, like Frank Capra has. This movie doesn't even begin to go that way.
So the premise is what? That he has had a loss in his life, a death in his family?
Yes. So he writes letters to time and love and death saying how upset he is with all of them.
And they answer him.
They answer him because his friends, and this is what I love, his friends are mad about losing the company, so they want to get their best friend declared mentally incompetent. So, I'm sorry, it's going to be hard to get through this without laughing because it's such a stupid movie. So they hire three actors to play love, time, and death to like meet him and talk with him.
Well, they hired a good woman in Helen Mirren.
They did hire a good one. She's the best thing in the movie.
She plays death.
Yeah, her character's like, I'm so good, I should play all three characters, and that's funny. But other than that, there was not a single thing in this movie. I mean, it's just such an insulting movie, you know? Shameless.
Sounds like the ghost of Christmas past, present, and future.
Me or the movie?
No, these characters that come in and play death and love, and it sounds like a Christmas Carol to me. Okay, so don't see it.
It wanted to be. It probably wanted to be.
Yeah, probably did.
It wanted to be.
Natalie Portman has put on the famous pink suit and assumed the role of Jackie Kennedy in Jackie. This concentrates on what happens after the assassination of JFK. And Matt, you say this makes no pretense at being a comprehensive biography, but unlike other films about that time period and about the Kennedys, is there any semblance of truth to this?
Oh, yeah, I think it does. It does a good job with that. It's basically, like you say, just sent around that one incident. But there are scenes where she's talking with a reporter later on. And that allows for other flashbacks and other bits of history in there and the whole Camelot mystique. And I thought it did quite a good job with all that.
I agree with that. And I thought, as good as she is, it is a really interesting decision to make as a film. Like, let's focus on a woman who's going through an unspeakable, yes, you know, unparalleled tragedy, mm-hmm, and figure out how she got through it. That's mm-hmm, the intense focus of this woman just lost, you know, her husband, who was the president of the United States. How is she going to rebound from it? And some of the most devastating moments are as the world is moving on, you know, past her. Lady Bird Johnson's trying to figure out what curtain she's going to hang in the White House. And Jackie's still there. Like, I'm still dealing with all of this. And
in a way, it's like the Warren Beatty movie Rules Don't Apply, in that it's kind of in this fractured way because a lot of it feels like you're watching it through her eyes, mm-hmm, which is just like, it's kind of like the Normandy battle scene.
So who's the audience for this? I mean, all these depressing
movies.
That's
a great question.
Academy voters, because Natalie Portman is tremendous in it. So
she is. Yeah. But again, I don't know what box office it's doing with Jackie. A lot. So many. They need positive word of mouth. They need people to come out and say, this is something you absolutely have to go see. But that audience, even going back 5 years, 10 years, that audience of people who would go see everything that gets nominated, I think is dwindling. I don't know if we necessarily have that strong of a support system in place. That even if you say, this thing got 10 nominations, it's really one of the best, people are always like, oh, I'll wait to see it later.
Well, there's a lot of that going on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because of the 65-inch televisions.
Yes, with the 4K resolution.
All right. Before we started, I walked in here and started talking about a movie I have yet to see.
We're running out of time.
I know it. Well, we'll talk about it now. La La Land. It's a it's a throwback to the Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers movies of old. Because they're singing and dancing by, I can't say these words in that phrase, Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone. So I have two questions. Can they sing and dance? And is there an audience for this?
Yes, there's definitely an audience. Yes, they can sing and dance. But also, even
but
more
are
than
they the, Fred and Ginger?
No, but here's the thing is,
are they pale carbon copies?
The writer-director, Damien Chazelle, he's a huge Jacques Demy fan who did The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which is more about everyday people breaking out into song and dance, as opposed to Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. So I think he does a bit of both. He tries to go for that old time realism, not realism, but magical aura of the old time musicals, more with the down to earth of the Demy movies.
And he said he was inspired by watching Judy Garland, Meet Me in St. Louis, and because he felt that not even though they broke out into song, they were real people. That's what he was trying to capture. I get that. But Judy Garland was a singer.
Right.
And she spent her life singing and dancing, as did Fred and Ginger.
Right.
Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone.
Immensely
are actors.
Talented.
But they didn't spend their early adulthood and childhood singing and dancing, did they?
Ryan Gosling was started on the Mickey Mouse Club.
Yeah, he danced on there.
I rest my case.
What this movie does better than any musical I've seen in years is by choosing to set itself in contemporary time, it says as much or more about trying to make it in the entertainment industry now. It's about people who abandon their normal lives to move to Los Angeles to make it in show business.
Because she's an actress trying to make it, and he's a jazz pianist trying to play alternative jazz and keeps getting fired because he won't play
classical. He wants to play classical jazz.
Okay.
And they're saying jazz has evolved beyond you. Okay. And they're trying to hold on. Well, she's not. To a certain extent, they're trying to figure out how to make it in this industry and how much everything is against you in trying to make it in this industry and how they maybe succeed.
And I am told that the opening number is worth the price of admission, and you'll be wondering how they did it.
If you don't have a smile plastered on your face by the end of the opening number, you are a soulless lump of coal. Right.
I will say this.
I will take you to the movie right now.
Thank
Let's
you.
Go.
Sean wanted to spend the entire hour talking about this
convincing
movie.
You.
And it's on both of your top five lists.
It's my number one. It's my number one of the year. It's the best thing I've seen this year. I've seen it four times in theaters already. I can't wait to go again.
And the smiles, you say, start almost immediately.
I just love it. I love the music in it. I love the way that he stages his choreography, his dance sequences. Mandy Moore is the one who did the choreography for it. She does So You Think You Can Dance. The two of them are so infectious together. Their chemistry is –
But it's not just all smiles, and that's partly what I like is there's some real tension in there between their characters and other characters, which I think gives it that more contemporary, real beat.
Who wrote the music?
I don't know.
John Kurtzel.
Are they memorable? Are the songs memorable?
Absolutely.
Yeah, songs.
Oh, absolutely. And what Chazelle does too, he did Whiplash. Did we talk about Whiplash with J.K. Simmons and the jazz drummer?
Right.
He comes up with his ending first and then sort of backfills to it. The ending of this film is so beautiful. So beautiful. It's amazing. And no one does that anymore. No one thinks about how we're going to end it. It's always like, what's your two-sentence premise to get people into the theaters? He's just a great filmmaker. And the way he structures his editing around his music, It's great.
I will put my skepticism in my back pocket and sit on it.
You have to see it on a big screen.
And if you hate it, Sean will give you a refund.
Yes.
And it's called La La Land because that's what Hollywood is called.
Correct,
by
exactly. Yes.
Okay, Assassin's Creed. A quick look at that. Opens on December 21st. Michael Fassbender experiencing the adventures of his 15th century Spanish ancestor. And we'll also talk about Lion. It's based on a true story of a 5-year-old Indian boy who falls asleep on a train, doesn't know where he is when he wakes up, is adopted by Australian parents, and later, because of Google Earth, finds his way back to his birth mother.
It's a very moving film. On paper, it sounds ridiculous, but
it's true.
But the way it starts,
he was on 60 Minutes last week.
No, it's a really good movie. It's really emotional. It's much better than I thought it was going to be.
What about Assassin's Creed?
We're seeing that in 1 hour.
Haven't seen it.
You're in a hurry then, aren't you?
We got a while.
Got the movies next. Sing opens on December 21st. It's an animated film about a grand singing competition for the world's animals.
I didn't see it.
I did. It's fun. I like that one.
Okay. That's it? It's fun?
Well, I mean, like I said, after Zootopia, everything's downhill.
Bryan Cranston is in a comedy with James Franco, a departure from Breaking Bad, so why him?
Seeing that tonight.
Oh, you haven't seen it yet? I was told everything on the list that you had seen. I was told everything.
Sean, I thought, had seen everything.
This is lies.
Well, then let's quickly talk about August Wilson's Fences. It's scheduled to open on Christmas Day, directed by and starring Denzel Washington, featuring Viola Davis. Washington also produced. It's a Tony Award and Pulitzer Prize winning play. How is it as a film?
Effective.
It's very, very good. But it is stagey. It's one of those that when you watch it, unlike, say, Amadeus, you know this came from a play. But with those actors, who cares?
Yeah, you buy a ticket because you want to see all the acting. Mm-hmm. And it delivers.
Yeah, and it will. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it delivers.
And August Wilson is an incredible writer. Mm. If you could only see three holiday films, what would they be?
In theaters right now?
Yeah.
La La Land, obviously.
We pretty much agree.
Arrival.
Those two.
For sure. You need to see that one on the big screen. And then I'm promoting A Monster Calls, which is coming out in theaters, and I'm over the moon for this movie. It's J.A. Bayona. It's about a young boy who's dealing with his mother who's dying of cancer, who gets visited by a tree monster. And I know it sounds silly, but it's deeply emotional, and bring tissues.
And my third would be Manchester by the Sea, if you can handle it, if you want a few tears with those laughs.
And which films would you wait until they're on HBO or Netflix or TBS?
Everything we talked about besides those three.
I'll share with the list.
Oh, Hidden Figures. Go see Hidden Figures, too. That's a really great crowd pleaser of a film.
We'll talk about this probably at Oscar time, but Sean O'Connell's top five films of the year, La La Land, A Monster Calls, Arrival, Sing Street, and Hell or High Water.
Yes.
Matt Brunson's top five, La La Land, Arrival, Zootopia, Manchester by the Sea, and Sing Street. Something to look forward to in just a couple of months. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.